If you have your Bibles, turn with me, if you would, to the Gospel of Luke. We're going to look at some verses beginning in the 9th chapter, starting in verse 28. Luke 9, beginning in verse 28. Now it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter, John, and James and went up on the mountain to pray. As he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him, who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and those with him were heavy with sleep. And when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Then it happened, as they were parting from him, that Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here, and let us make 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were fearful as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." And the voice had ceased. Jesus was found alone. But they kept quiet and told no one in those days any of the things they had seen. There was a couple who was attending a meeting in Rome, Italy. And their first stop was a tour of Vatican City. Michelangelo's work in the Sistine Chapel had just been renovated, and for hours they waited in line for a glimpse of this remarkable feat. At a distance, the painting kind of looked not all that impressive. People were chattering and they were joking about how they could get paint-by-number replicas of Michelangelo's work and reproduce it on the ceiling in their home. But as they drew closer, they were overwhelmed. The painting seemed to engulf them. Everyone became very quiet, and all the necks were ached as they looked up in an effort to just keep looking at all of the vastness of that beautiful scene. Now, as they were seeing the paintings as Michelangelo intended for them to be seen, finally standing below them. And that impact was unforgettable. Trish and I have seen it. It is overwhelming. And then the couple noticed that there was a fly crawling across the ceiling, across the painting. And they thought, what a shame. What a shame. That fly is right up there where we would love to be. Close. He's right on top of it. But he just can't see. Brings to mind the words of the philosopher William Irwin Thompson, who wrote, "We are like flies crawling across the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. We can't see what angels and gods lie beneath the threshold of our perception." You notice I titled this, "Flies on the Ceiling of the Sistine Chapel." And if you go back to what we read here in the 9th chapter of Luke, Luke's account here is kind of like a series of magnificent paintings in and of itself. The setting for each painting is apparently a mountaintop, for they were up on a mountain. And in the first painting, we see Jesus there and the inner circle, I guess you could say, of his disciples. There was Peter and James and John, and Jesus is praying. And then it says the disciples were sleeping. And then in the second painting, you can see Jesus, he's praying. And as he does so, apparently his face seems to be changed and his clothes become as white as, I guess, a flash of lightning. And two men appear, Moses and Elijah. Peter and his companions, once asleep, it says. now fully awake, Peter says this to Christ in verse 33, "Master, it's good for us to be here. And let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." It's interesting that Luke adds that Peter didn't know what he was saying. Then there's a third thing. You envision a cloud. It kind of encompasses all of these men. And the disciples, somewhat hidden by this cloud, are apparently afraid. And a voice comes down from the cloud, loud, and saying, "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." And then there's a final thing. The voice is silent. Cloud's gone. So are Moses and Elijah, and it's just Jesus and his three disciples, and they're alone once more. But there must have been something strange and mysterious upon the faces of the disciples, because as they came down in verse 35, it said they kept quiet, and they told no one in those days of any of the things that they had seen. How do we deal with these four memorable paintings of what we call the Mount of Transfiguration? Do we, like some, go into a museum, we look at a painting, we study it very briefly, kind of marvel at the hand of the artist, and then we move on to another notable painting, really giving no thought what the intent of the artist was? Or worse, are we like flies on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and the work is monumental, but we're so close to it we can't see any of it, and we don't have the powers to discern its ultimate worth? Or shall we look for some deeper meaning, some relevant truth that this story about the Mount of Transfiguration gives us, something about our lives, about our destiny? In reality, if you look what we read here in Luke chapter 9, it's the entire essence of the Christian faith, all summed up in just a few verses and in these four paintings that I just described. They speak to the very heart of what we believe about life, about God, about our reason for being. Let's sum up what these paintings might say. I think the first thing it says is this: there is more to reality than what we can hear and see and touch and taste and smell. Now, it was a mountaintop experience for Peter, James, and John, but it was no ordinary mountaintop experience. It wasn't just the fact that these three men went up with Jesus and they saw the beauty of the creation. Sometimes we do that. We go stand and look at a beautiful mountain and we say, "Oh, this is all beautiful." In the classic tragic play called Faust, the writer Goethe describes a pact that Dr. Faust makes with the devil. The pact says that Faust can satisfy his every human want and every desire except one. Never, never, under any circumstances, can he stop and say to the passing moment, "Wait, you're so beautiful." The world is beautiful. Intricate, perfect. You study those kind of things, the scientists tell us that the Earth is tilted at 23 degrees. And that if it wasn't at 23 degrees, it was something more or something less, we wouldn't have the seasons that we have. In fact, if it wasn't tilted exactly like it's tilted, they say vapors would go from both the north and the south, and they would begin to pile up, continents full of ice. We go out at night and we look at the moon. They say if the moon was 50,000 miles away instead of 200,000 miles away, probably the tide would rise and fall so much each day that it would flood all of the continents in the world. They say if the crust of the earth was 10 feet thicker than what it is, there'd be no oxygen. I don't know why that is. And without oxygen, we wouldn't be alive. No beast would be alive. All earth would be dead. The story goes on and on. From the vastness of the earth to the integral of the particles that make up every part of it, the world is magical. The world is mystical. The world is magnificent. And it overwhelms our senses to contemplate the glory of the creation that God has made. But the Mount of Transfiguration tells us something different, something more. It says you can take the sum of everything beautiful, everything wonderful that you have ever experienced, everything you've had with your five senses, with sight and hearing and touch and taste and smell, and we could add all the good feelings that we've ever experienced in life about friends and about family and about health and hope. And we can include all of the things like happiness and joy and peace. And the Mount of Transfiguration story says there's still more. There's a reality that our scientific instruments can't measure. Best philosophical minds can't fathom. Most sophisticated rockets can't reach. The realm of the spiritual. It's the reality of the living God. There's more to reality than just what we sense and detect with our senses. The Gospel of John reminds us over in John chapter 4, verse 24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And we read that and we say, okay, we don't really understand that. Spirit. God is a spirit. That must have been the impact that Peter, James, and John on that day came to realize, that there's more than what we can just hear and see and touch and taste and smell. There's a second thought. There's more to living than dying. You look around, a lot of us live in this world very sad. You could even say meaningless lives. We live in a secular world. We turn on the TV, we listen to the radio, we read the newspaper, and all the debate, all the discussion that goes on is about all the great issues of our time, but seldom, if ever, is there a question raised about what is the ultimate value, what is the will of God, what is the eternal consequences of our actions. Why? Because most people live with the expectation that life really does end at the grave. Our whole attitude about death has taken radical change in the last 100 years or so. There's an amazing story in the newspapers years ago about the presidency of George H.W. Bush, that Daddy Bush. And the story was about the mail that they received at the White House. They said during his reign, they got 50 to 60,000 letters mailed to the White House every day. No, excuse me, every week. Don't want to overdo it. Even the first dog, you remember her name? Millie, received mail. One volunteer had the sole responsibility of responding to every letter that came in concerning the dog Millie. And apparently when you got a response back, it included a paw print. You probably don't know it, but Millie wrote a book called Millie's Book, as dictated to Barbara Bush. But I'm talking about mail he received. And President Bush received one day the strangest piece of mail, an invitation to a funeral of a man described as a, quote, hardworking, patriotic American. The problem was the man wasn't dead. His family explained that he was hooked up to a life support system and that if it met the schedule of President Bush to attend when he came, they'd pull the plug. Can you imagine that? I guess you could call that death on demand or death with dignity. It's code words for our time. But Christians see death in a different way. Christians see death as having been defeated. Here on the Mount of Transfiguration, the disciples see Jesus, but they also see Moses and Elijah. How long has Moses and Elijah been dead? 500 years? 1,000 years? I don't know. It doesn't matter. But in the spiritual realm, there's no measure of time. You can take the time and go through your gospel. Matthew, Mark, and Luke specifically all record words that Jesus said when Jesus said, God is the God of the living. And there's more to living than dying. The beautiful story that was in Focus on the Family magazine years ago. It was titled, A Letter for Luke. About an 11-year-old young man, a boy, whose name was Landon. And he stood in front of his mom one day and said, I wish I could write a letter to you. And the mother could see that the tears were being held back in little Landon's face. He tried not to shed them because 9 months before, Landon's good friend, Luke, died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage. So Landon's grief was deep. As the mom described it, it was unreachable, and all she could do was really just hold him when he cried, but she longed to ease his pain. So she thought, maybe writing a letter would be a good idea. So she handed Landon some paper and a whole bunch of colored pencils. And she said, tell Luke how much you miss him, how much you love him. Tell him you haven't forgotten. And Luke got to work. He wrote the letter, a long letter. And the completed work was a work of art, like Michelangelo's. I mean, he put every line in a different colored pencil. He made an elaborate border around every page. It was a love letter, a message from earth to heaven. To his friend, Luke. And he folded the paper, and he took it to his mom. And together they asked God if God would give Luke the message that Landon wrote. But that was not enough. Landon thought for a little bit, and he said, Mom, what I really want to do is tie my letter to a balloon. I know it really can't get to heaven, but he never really finished the sentence. Mom nodded. She drove him to the store. He chose a pink neon helium balloon. And they carefully tied the note to the bottom string of the balloon, and they drove up to a steep butte there at the edge of town. Beautiful. Up there on top, you could see the deserts and the mountains, and and a gentle breeze was blowing. And Landon took the balloon out to the edge, and he let it go, and the breeze instantly danced it away from his fingers, as if they knew the importance of what the message was. Up it went. And they watched. And he said to his mom, "I wish something would happen that I would know God got the message, not the letter." His mother wished the same thing would happen too, but the prophetic side of her spoke up and said, she assured that God would give the message to Luke for him not to worry about it. But he said to his mom, I know, but I wish I could see something. And then the sky got very thick, got very dark. The clouds were coming in. And the balloon was getting smaller and smaller as it got up towards those dark clouds, and they watched. And then suddenly, just about the time in which the balloon was going to go out of sight, a hole occurred in the dark cloud, and that balloon sailed right through the daylight. His jaw dropped. Did you see that? God got my balloon. And as she drove him back to their home, she knew indeed that God did get that letter to give to Luke. And she felt perhaps what Peter, James, and John felt as that cloud enveloped them on the Mount of Transfiguration. John beautifully described what happens to the Christian as we contemplate the effect of death on us in this earthly place in which we live. And you know these words are found over in John, the 14th chapter, beginning in verse 1. They read like this. "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself. For where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know. And the way, you know." There's more to life than our senses can detect. There's more to living than dying. And third thought. There's more to the Christian commitment than just going to the mountaintop. Maybe there should be another painting of what's described here in the Mount of Transfiguration, and it would show Jesus and the three disciples, and they're not on the mountain anymore. They're down in the valley. They're meeting the needs of people. Peter suggested, while we're up here on the mountain, let's build three booths, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And it's interesting that Luke says he didn't know what he was saying. Followers of Jesus who believe in a spiritual realm and who believe that there's more to living than dying aren't given the luxury of sitting on the mountain and twiddling their thumbs. We got to seek out the least and the lost. The lowest, those that need to be ministered to. Minister and author by the name of Jay Adams, who wrote and writes extensively about counseling based upon spiritual scriptures. And he tells about a friend who went on a missionary trip to New Guinea. In some years, he was in service there in New Guinea in a region called the Fly River region. And he returned and he came to Adams, and Adams asked him, "Tell me what you found at our station in New Guinea." "Bound," said his friend. "I found something that looked more hopeless than if I had been sent into the jungle to a lot of lions." "What do you mean?" asked I. "Why, those people are totally void of moral sense. They're worse than beasts. If a mother's carrying her little baby and the baby starts to cry, she'll just throw it into the ditch and let it die. If a man saw his father fall and break his leg, he'd leave him in the ditch by the roadside to die. They have no compassion. Whatever. They don't even know what it means. Well, what did you do for the people like that? Did you preach to them, Adam's asked? Preach? No. I lived. Live. How did you live? When I saw a forsaken baby, I comforted it. When I saw a man with a broken leg, I mended it. When I saw people in distress, I took them in and I pitied them. I took care of them. I lived that way. And those people began to come to me and say, what does this mean? What are you doing this for? Then I had my chance. And I preached the gospel. Did you succeed, Adam? When I left, said his friend, I left the church. That's the test of every mountaintop experience that we have. Does it motivate us to reach out to our neighbor? Does it motivate us to reach down to the least and the lowest? There's no staying up on the mountain. Peter, James, and John, they came down and they went to work. We have the evidence of their work and the work of established churches. We are part of that. So how about you? How do you feel about the portraits that Luke has given us about Christ's transfiguration? And you're the art critic who looks at it, views it with cool disattachment, and then moves on to the next. Or worse still, are you a fly on the ceiling? You're so close to it, you don't even see what God has planned for you. The beauty that's there. Are you willing and ready to come down off the mountain to go to work? That's the message this morning. Christ calls each of us to come through faith, repentance of our sin, confessing that we believe that Jesus is the Christ. You need to be baptized, immersed, to wash away those sins. We can do that. We can do it now, today, tonight, anytime. And then rise to be what the Mount of Transfiguration tells us. And that is servants for the greater good of God. How much you will to stand?